Chapter 6 The High Plains of Eden. Angie and her sister, along with some of the other girls of the Sib, crowded around the doorway into the chapel. The cowhide covering that usually hid the interior from view had been removed. This was the time of the fall festival celebrating the bounty of the great goddess. The great women of the city, their hair greased back, their breasts and thighs covered with a gray-blue color of ceremonial ash, were kneeling and singing around the festooned and tranced figure of the goddess. She was resplendent, lying on the horn recliner with bunches of flowers and offerings of pine nuts heaped about her. Watching through the flickering of many lamps, the young observers never so much as imagined that what they saw was not the goddess herself, her pregnant form rising and falling in deep sleep, but a wooden statue inset with a fine obsidian for which the city was famous, and rubbed with generations of pigments and fat until her skin shone with the same deep ebony luster as that of the city's people. In a small open space at the foot of the goddess, three of the shamans of the highest, most secret order danced slowly in vulture costumes, whose shadows mingled hypnotically with similar vultures painted on the whitewashed walls. At the conclusion of the dance, richly painted wood vessels with lids were brought from a niche in the wall and unwrapped from covers of dyed and woven fabric. Everyone present, even our little spies at the doorway, knew that the mushroom, she of many names, was within, and the sacrament was brought forth and distributed to be eaten among the women present. It was a rare privilege for the girls to be ignored and so allowed to witness the Harvest Mother mysteries, a mark of their rising status with the women, really. Each knew that in a few years she would take her place as an initiate into the ritual which they now beheld but could not understand. Though she was only 8 and her sister Slinga was 6, Angie knew that what they saw no man of the city had ever seen. The men's mysteries were different, also secret, also never spoken of. The Tassili Plateau. Archaeological evidence for these speculative ideas can be found in the Sahara Desert of southern Algeria, in an area called the Tassili-Niger Plateau. A curious geological formation, the plateau is like a labyrinth, a vast badlands of stone escarpments that have been cut by the wind into many perpendicular narrow corridors. Aerial photographs give the eerie impression of an abandoned city. In the Tassili-Niger, rock paintings date from the late Neolithic to as recently as 2,000 years ago. Here are the earliest known depictions of shamans with large numbers of grazing cattle. The shamans are dancing with fists full of mushrooms and also have mushrooms sprouting out of their bodies. In one instance, they are shown running joyfully, surrounded by the geometric structures of their hallucinations. The pictorial evidence seems incontrovertible. Images similar to those of the Tassili occur in pre-Columbian Peruvian textiles. In these textiles, the shamans hold objects that may be mushrooms, but may also be chopping tools. With the Tassili frescoes, however, the case is clear. At Madeline Amazar and Tien Tazarift on the Tassili, the dancing shamans clearly have mushrooms in their hands and sprouting from their bodies. The pastoral peoples who produced the Tassili paintings gradually moved out of Africa over a long period of time, from 20,000 to 7,000 years ago. Wherever they went, their pastoral lifestyle went with them. The Red Sea was landlocked during much of this time. Lowered sea levels meant that the boot of Arabia was backed up against the African continent. Land bridges at both ends of the Red Sea were utilized by some of these African pastoralists to enter the Fertile Crescent and Asia Minor, where they intermingled with hunter-gatherer populations already present. The pastoral mode has been well established across the ancient Near East by 12,000 years ago. These pastoral people brought with them a cult of cattle and a cult of the great goddess. The evidence that they had such cults comes from rock paintings in the Tassili-Niger that are from what scholars have named the Round Head Period. This period is named for the style of depiction of the human figure in these paintings, a style not known from any other site. The Roundhead Civilization. The Roundhead period is believed to have begun early and probably ended before the 7th millennium BP. Henry Lote estimates that the Roundhead period lasted several thousand years, placing its beginning somewhere near the start of the 9th millennium. That the great goddess was part of the worldview of the Roundhead style painters is beyond dispute. A painting from Ineo Honorhat in the Tassili includes a wonderful image of a dancing woman. With her outstretched arms and horns extended horizontally on either side of her head, she is the embodiment of the great horned goddess. Her discoverer saw her as having a relationship with the Egyptian great goddess Isis, mythical protector of the cultivation of grain. This impressive figure highlights one of the many problems raised by the Tassili finds. Why, if done at a time when the stratigraphy of the Nile Valley shows it to have been nearly deserted, do many of the paintings of the Roundhead period show an unmistakable Egyptian influence in content and style? The logical conclusion is that these motifs and stylistic conceits that we associate with ancient Egypt were first introduced into Egypt by the dwellers of the Western Desert. If proven, this suggestion would indicate the Central Sahara as the source of what later became the high civilization of pre-dynastic Egypt. Paradise found? The Tassili Naja'ir of 12,000 BC may well have been the partnership paradise whose loss has created one of the most persistent and poignant of our mythological motifs, the nostalgia for paradise, the idea of a lost golden age of plenty, partnership, and social balance. The contention here is that the rise of language, partnership society, and complex religious ideas may have occurred not far from the area where humans emerged, the game-filled, mushroom-dotted grasslands and savannas of tropical and subtropical Africa. There, the partnership society arose and flourished. There, hunter-gatherer culture slowly gave way to domestication of animals and plants. In this milieu, the psilocybin-containing mushrooms were encountered, consumed, and deified. Language, poetry, ritual, and thought emerged from the darkness of the hominid mind. Eden was not a myth. For the prehistoric peoples of the high plateau of the Tassili Naja'ir, Eden was home. The end of that story may well be the beginning of our own. Is it mere coincidence that at the beginning of the source code of Western civilization, in the book of Genesis, we read an account of history's first drug bust? Chapter 3, verse 6. When the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good to eat, and that it was pleasing to the eye and pleasing to contemplate, she took some and ate it. She also gave her husband some, and he ate it. Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they discovered that they were naked. So they stitched fig leaves together and made themselves loincloths. Chapter 3, verse 22. The Lord God made tunics of skin for Adam and his wife and clothed them. He said, "The man has become like one of us, knowing good and evil. What if he now reaches out his hand and takes fruit from the tree of life also, eats it and lives forever?" So the Lord God drove him out of the Garden of Eden to till the ground from which he had been taken. He cast him out, and to the east of the Garden of Eden, he stationed the cherubim and a sword whirling and flashing to guard the way to the tree of life. The story of Genesis is the story of a woman who is mistress of the magical plants. She eats and shares the fruits of the tree of life, or the tree of knowledge, fruits which are pleasing to the eye and pleasing to contemplate. Note that the eyes of both of them were opened, and they discovered that they were naked. At the metaphorical level, they had attained consciousness of themselves as individuals, and of each other as other. So the fruit of the tree of knowledge gave accurate insights, or perhaps it enhanced their appreciation of sensuality. Whichever the case, this ancient story of our ancestors being cast out of a garden by a spiteful and insecure Jehovah, a storm god, is the story of a goddess-oriented partnership society thrown into disequilibrium by successive episodes of drought that affected the carrying capacity and climate of the pastoralist Saharan Eden. The angel with the flashing sword who guards the return to Eden seems an obvious symbol of the unforgiving harshness of the desert sun and the severe drought conditions that accompany it. Tension between male and female is close to the surface in this story, and indicates that at the time the story was first recorded, the change from partnership to dominator-style cultures was already well advanced. The woman ate of the fruit of the tree of knowledge. This mysterious fruit is the psilocybin-containing mushroom Stropharia cubensis that catalyzed the Tassili partnership Eden and then maintained it through a religion that placed a premium on frequent dissolution of personal boundaries into the oceanic presence of the great goddess, who was also called Gaia, G-O-G, the Earth. John Pfeiffer, in discussing the Upper Paleolithic cave art of Europe, makes a number of observations that are important for these ideas. He believes that the placement of art within the caves and often nearly inaccessible spots is related to the use of the sites for initiation ceremonies that involved quite complex theatrical effects. He further suggests that what he calls twilight state thinking is a precondition to having great culturally sanctioned truths revealed. Twilight state thinking is characterized by a loss of objectivity, temporal distortion, and a tendency to experience mild hallucinations, and is nothing more than a gloss for egoless and unbounded psychedelic arousal. The presence of twilight state thinking, our very susceptibility to the condition, argues for its evolutionary importance. In extreme cases, it results in pathology, derangements and delusions, persisting hallucinations, and fanaticism. But it is also the driving force behind efforts to see things whole, to achieve a variety of syntheses from unified field theories in physics to blueprints for utopias in which people live together in peace. There must have been an enormous selective premium on the twilight state during prehistoric times. If the pressures of the Upper Paleolithic demanded fervid belief and the following of leaders for survival's sake, then individuals endowed with such qualities, with a capacity to fall readily into trances, would out-reproduce more resistant individuals. Pfeiffer neglects to discuss psychoactive plants and any role they might have played in bringing about twilight thought, and he limits his discussion to Europe. However, the placement of the Tassili rock paintings is similar to that of paintings in many of the European sites, and so it can be presumed that the paintings were used for generally similar purposes. Most likely, similar religious rites were practiced across southern Europe and North Africa. The retreat of the glaciers from the Eurasian landmass and the simultaneous acceleration of aridity in the African grasslands eventually brought the casting out of Eden allegorically conveyed in Genesis. The mushroom peoples of Tassili Nagier began to move east of Eden, and in fact it is possible to trace this migration in the archaeological record. A missing link culture. In the middle of the 10th millennium BC, Palestine, which had been only lightly populated, was the site of the sudden appearance of a remarkably advanced culture that brought with it an explosion in the size of settlements and in arts, crafts, and technologies such as had never before been seen in the Near East, or for that matter, anywhere on this planet. This is the Natufian culture, whose crescent moon flints and elegantly naturalistic carved bonework are unrivaled by anything contemporary found in Europe. As James Mellart writes, there is in the early Natufian a love of art, sometimes naturalistic, sometimes more schematized. The crouching limestone figurine from the cave of Ez-Zuwitna, or the handle of a sickle from El Wad showing a faun, are superb examples of naturalistic art, worthy of Upper Paleolithic France. In spite of the assumption of European academic archaeology that such a culture must have had links with the settlements of old Europe, the skeletal evidence from Jericho, where the Natufian culture reached its peak, shows clearly that the inhabitants were of Eurafrican stock, fairly robust with long skulls. The ceramic evidence also favors the notion of an African origin. Occurring in the Natufian sites is dark, burnished, monochrome pottery that is known as Sahara Sudanese ware. Pottery of this type has been found near the Egyptian-Sudanese border in a situation that suggests that domesticated cattle was present, and it has been found in and near the Tassili Nagier, evidently having appeared at the end of the Roundhead period. Mary Sedegast wrote, "The origin of these African ceramics is unknown. Very recent excavations of the Ti and Tora in the Libyan Sahara have uncovered Sahara Sudanese-type pottery with one carbon-14 reading of 7100 BC, which, if a reliable date, would suggest a Western seniority." Such statements support the notion that a high culture to the west of the Nile was the source of the new advanced culture appearing in the Nile Valley and Palestine. Of interest in this context is the Natufian culture's particularly close and intense involvement with plants. Inquiry into the relationship of environmental and behavioral systems from 10,000 to 8,000 BC reveals that the subsistence base of Natufian populations did not differ appreciably from the local Upper Paleolithic tradition. However, the emphases on plant resources in the Natufian allowed for a storable surplus which, in turn, had an effect on the Natufian behavioral patterns. Much of the Natufian material culture, architecture, grinding stones, and settlement pattern was influenced by an intensive exploitation of plant resources. African genesis. If the source of the oldest ceramics at the Natufian sites is North African, this would suggest strongly that the Natufian source culture was the previously disrupted partnership paradise that flourished in the wetter and more western regions of the Sahara, especially the Tassili Nagier. Archaeology may eventually provide the answers, but to date, no archaeology of significance has been done with these questions in mind. The Western Sahara has not been taken seriously as a possible source of the advanced culture that entered Palestine in the mid-10th millennium BC. The result of this failure is reflected in comments like the following. What is puzzling, however, is that the Palestinian sequence provides nothing at all convincing for an ancestor for the very original first stages of the Natufian. The industry which immediately precedes it is a rather uninteresting culture, having very little in common with its successor. The Natufian, in fact, makes its first appearance apparently full-grown, with no traceable roots in the past. The early Natufians in Palestine settled caves and the terraces in front of caves, and it was in precisely such situations that the rock paintings in the Tassili were done. Further excavation of the major roundhead mural finds in the Tassili might reveal traces of the precocious civilization that is the Natufian source culture. Cattle Hayuk. If the Tassili Naji'ir can claim consideration as the original Eden and westernmost location of partnership culture, then certainly Cattle Hayuk in central Anatolia must be seen as its Neolithic and Eastern culmination. Cattle Hayuk has been called a premature flash of brilliance and complexity, and an immensely rich and luxurious city. The stratigraphy for the site begins in the middle of the 9th millennium BC. Elaboration of cultural forms reaches a pinnacle in Cattle Level 6 in the middle of the 7th millennium BC. Cattle Hayuk was a huge settlement, spreading over 32 acres of the Konya Plain and, at its peak, accommodating over 7,000 people. Although barely begun, the excavation of Cattle Hayuk has already yielded amazing shrines with cattle bas-reliefs and heads of now-extinct aurochs, Bos primigenius, covered with ochre designs, the very complex paintings of a complicated civilization. Cattle Hayuk's complexity has puzzled archaeologists. Less than 3% of the site has been explored, but Cattle Hayuk has already yielded a wealth of religious art and symbolism that appears to be 3,000 or 4,000 years ahead of its time. The mature complexity of the traditions at this Neolithic site further presupposes, according to the excavator, an Upper Paleolithic ancestor of whom we have no trace. I contend that the Upper Paleolithic ancestor of which we have no trace is the culture of the Tassili Naji'ir. The Natufian culture was a transitional culture directly linking the roundhead culture in Africa with Cattle Hayuk. In support of this rather startling statement, consider the following observations by other scholars. Mellart said of the agriculture at Cattle, "Everything indicates that the plant husbandry of Cattle Hayuk must have a long prehistory somewhere else, in a region where the wild ancestors of these plants were at home, presumably in hilly country, well away from the man-made environment of the Konya Plain. The beginnings must be sought in the Natufian of Palestine, the still unknown earlier aceramic of the Anatolian Plateau of Turkey and in Khuzestan, farther to the east." Here is Mellart on the material culture at Cattle. In contrast to other contemporary Neolithic cultures, Cattle Hayuk preserved a number of traditions that seem archaic in a fully developed Neolithic society. The art of wall painting, the reliefs modeled in clay or cut out of the wall plaster, the naturalistic representations of animals, human figures, and deities, the occasional use of finger-impressed clay designs like macaroni, the developed use of geometric ornament including spirals and meanders, incised on seals or transferred to a new medium of weaving. The modeling of animals wounded in hunting rites, the practice of red ochre burials, the archaic amulets in the form of a bird-like steatopygus goddess, and finally, certain types of stone tools and the preference for dentalium shells and jewelry all preserve remains of an Upper Paleolithic heritage. To a greater or less extent, such archaic elements are also traceable in a number of other post-Paleolithic cultures, such as the Natufian of Palestine, but nowhere are they so pronounced as in the Neolithic of Cattle Hayuk. Writing of the painted walls at Cattle Hayuk, Sedegast made this observation. "The range of pigments used by the cattle artists was unmatched in the Near East, although equaled or surpassed in the roundhead art of the Sahara. A third type of decoration was accomplished by cutting out silhouettes of animals from the deep accumulations of plaster on the walls, a curious use of interior surfaces that Mellart, the excavator, believes may have been carried over from the techniques of rock art. The elegant naturalism of the art at Cattle Hayuk is an echo of the beautiful and sensitive renderings of cattle that typify the Tassili art finds." Speaking of the inspired animal art of the Upper Paleolithic, Mellart writes, "We have already seen a faint survival of the naturalistic style in the Natufian of Palestine, but it was far more marked in the wall paintings and plaster engravings of the Neolithic site of Catalhayuk. There, this naturalistic art survived until the middle of the 58th century BC, but it is no longer found in the later culture of Hasselar or Khan-Hassan, cultures which followed in the same area. What could account for the vitiation of the naturalistic spirit in archaic art that accompanies the changeover from hunting-gathering to agriculture? While the absence of the inspiring mushroom and the visual acuity it imparted cannot be the sole cause, its loss may well have sapped the vitality of the archaic vision. The goddess-worshipping pastoralists saw more deeply into nature, and their naturalistic style sacrificed esoteric symbolic representation to visual realism, often of the most pristine sort. The most common motifs at Catalhayuk are cattle and bulls, and secondarily, vultures and leopards, all animals of the African grasslands. Of the vultures, Sedegast says, "In any event, if the vulture theme did enter Catalhayuk at level 8 with the pre-dynastic style flint daggers and possibly Sahara Sudanese-related ceramics, as the excavations to this point suggest, the chance that some of this Anatolian vulture symbolism was actually African cannot be ruled out." The conclusion that peoples and cultural institutions long old in Africa were entering and flourishing for a time in the Near Eastern environment is logical and difficult to avoid. Mellart is puzzled that Catalhayuk left no great impact on subsequent cultures in the area, remarking that the Neolithic cultures of Anatolia introduced the first beginnings of agriculture and stock breeding and a cult of the mother goddess, the basis of our civilization. A basis many today still deny, it may fairly be added. Rianne Eisler, who has examined the psychology and mechanisms for maintaining cultural equilibrium in partnership society, argues convincingly that the later pattern to emerge, that of the dominator society, came with the Indo-Europeans, the horse-mounted wheeled vehicle cultures from the cold country north of the Black Sea. These are the people of the controversial and hypothetical Kurgan waves of Indo-European population movement. On this matter, Eisler's position echoes that of Maria Gumbutas, who wrote, "The term Old Europe is applied to a pre-Indo-European culture of Europe, a culture matrifocal and probably matrilinear, agricultural and sedentary, egalitarian and peaceful. It contrasted sharply with the ensuing Proto-Indo-European culture, which was patriarchal, stratified, pastoral, mobile, and war-oriented, superimposed on all Europe except the southern and western fringes, in the course of three waves of infiltration from the Russian steppe, between 4500 and 2500 BC. During and after this period, the female deities, or more accurately, the goddess creatrix and her many aspects, were largely replaced by the predominantly male divinities of the Indo-Europeans. What developed after circa 2500 BC was a melange of the two mythic systems, Old European and Indo-European. Gimbutas believes, in short, that the sedentary matrilinear civilization of Old Europe was disrupted by successive waves of Indo-European invaders with a different culture and language. Cambridge archaeologist Colin Renfrew has offered an alternative interpretation of this Kurgan Waves theory of Indo-European language diffusion. He claims Catalhayuk is the point of origin of the Indo-European language group and the area most likely to be implicated in the invention of agriculture. To support his unorthodox views, Renfrew calls upon the linguistic findings of Vladislav M. Ilitch-Vidich and Aaron Dolgopolsky, which also point toward Anatolia as the home of the Indo-European languages. Dolgopolsky's student Sergei Starostin has argued that about 7,000 years ago, Indo-Europeans borrowed a massive number of words from the North Caucasian language of Anatolia. The date of this borrowing argues for our conclusion that Catalhayuk was not founded by Indo-Europeans who would have migrated there during a much later period. The recent genetic findings of Luigi Cavalli Savorza and Alan C. Wilson at Berkeley also seem to support this conclusion. The Berkeley group analyzed blood groupings of living populations and traced the population's genetic roots. They concluded that there is a close genetic relationship among the speakers of Afro-Asiatic and the Indo-European languages. Their work also supports the view that populations with linguistic roots in Africa had been living on the Anatolian plateau long before the appearance of the Indo-Europeans. The legacy of Catalhayuk was suppressed precisely because of the culture's deep association with the mother goddess. The orgiastic, psychedelic religion that worshipped the mother goddess made the cattle culture anathema to the new dominator style of warfare and hierarchy. This was a cultural style that arrived suddenly and without warning. The domestication of the horse and discovery of the wheel allowed the Indo-European tribal populations to move south of the Zagros Mountains for the first time. Horse-mounted plunder brought the dominator style to Anatolia and trampled beneath its hooves the last great partnership civilization. Plunder replaced pastoralism, mead cults finally completed the already well-advanced process of supplanting mushroom use, human god kings replaced the religion of the goddess. However, at its height, the cult of Cattle Hayuk represented the most advanced and coherent expression of religious feeling in the world. We have very little evidence upon which to reconstruct the nature of the cult acts performed, but the sheer number of shrines in relation to the total number of rooms bespeaks a culture obsessed with religious observances. We know that this was a cult of totemic animals, the vulture, the hunting cat, and always preeminent, the bull or the cow. Later religions in the ancient Middle East were bull-worshipping in spirit, but we cannot assume this for Cattle Hayuk. The sculpted heads of cattle that protrude into the cattle shrines at Cattle Hayuk are sexually ambiguous and may represent bulls or cows or simply cattle generally. However, the prevalence of female symbolism in the shrines is overwhelming. For example, the breasts of sculpted stucco that are apparently randomly placed makes it seem likely that the religious officials were women. The presence of built-in recliners in some shrines suggests that curing or midwifery in a shamanic style may have been part of the rites. It is impossible not to see in the cult of the great goddess and the cattle cult of the late Neolithic a recognition of the mushroom as the third and hidden member of a kind of shamanic trinity. The mushroom, seen to be as much a product of cattle as our milk, meat, and manure, was recognized very early as the physical connection to the presence of the goddess. This is the secret that was lost some 6,000 years ago at the eclipse of Cattle Hayuk. The crucial difference. I am in general agreement with Eisler's view expressed in The Chalice and the Blade, and hope only to extend her argument by asking the following question. What factor maintained the equilibrium of the partnership societies of the late Neolithic and then faded, setting the stage for the emergence of the evolutionarily maladaptive dominator model? In my thinking on this matter, I have been guided by a belief that the depth of the relationship of a human group to the gnosis of the transcendent other, the Gaian collectivity of organic life, determines the strength of the group's connection to the archetype of the goddess and hence to the partnership style of social organization. I base this assumption on observation of shamans in the Amazon and on observation of the impact of plant hallucinogens on my own psychology and that of my peers. The mainstream of Western thought ceased to be refreshed by the gnosis of the boundary-dissolving plant hallucinogens long before the close of the Minoan era, circa 850 BC. In Crete and in nearby Greece, awareness of the vegetable logos continued as an esoteric and diminished presence until the Eleusinian mysteries were finally suppressed by enthusiastic Christian barbarians in AD 268. The consequence of that severed connection is the modern world, a planet dying under moral anesthesia. Suppression of the feminine and of knowledge of the natural world has been the hallmark of the intervening centuries. The late medieval church that conducted the great witch burnings wanted all magic and derangement to be attributed to the devil. For this reason, it suppressed all knowledge of plants such as thorn apple, datura, deadly nightshade, and monk's hood, and of the role these plants were playing in the nocturnal activities of the practitioners of witchcraft. And this role was an extensive one. Flying ointments and magical salves were compounded out of datura roots and seeds, parts of the plant rich in delirium and delusion-producing tropane alkaloids. When this material was applied to the witch's body, it produced states of extraordinary derangement and delusion. Hans Baldung's treatment of this subject leaves no doubt about the terror of the other the medieval mind projected on the image of intoxicated women. But in the accounts of the Inquisition, the central role of plants was never stressed. After all, the church had no interest in a devil who was such a diminished figure that he must rely on mere herbs to work his wiles. The devil must be a worthy foe of the Christos, and hence nearly co-equal. We must assume that the role of mind-altering plants in some witches' flights was not only underemphasized, but entirely suppressed for a reason. If this had not been done, then a natural explanation for such phenomena would have suggested itself. Something, in fact, advanced by the physicians, philosophers, and magicians quoted here, such as Porta, Weir, and Cardanus. The devil then would have been left with only a very modest significance, or none at all. if he was assigned nothing more than the role of carnival conjurer, who caused mere illusions to flame up in the heads of witches, he could not have fulfilled the function assigned to him, namely the mighty enemy and seducer of Christendom. The Vegetable Mind. In view of our present cultural impasse, I conclude that the next evolutionary step must involve not only a repudiation of dominator culture, but an archaic revival and a rebirth of awareness of the goddess. Implicit in the ending of profane and secular history is the notion of our involvement with the reemergence of the vegetable mind. That same mind that coaxed us into self-reflecting language now offers us the boundless landscapes of the imagination. This is the same vision of human fulfillment through the divine imagination that was presciently glimpsed by William Blake. Without such a visionary relationship to psychedelic exopheromones that regulate our symbiotic relationship with the plant kingdom, we stand outside of an understanding of planetary purpose. And understanding planetary purpose may be the major contribution that we can make to the evolutionary process. Returning to the balance of the planetary partnership style means trading the point of view of the egoistic dominator for the intuitional, feeling-toned understanding of the maternal matrix. A rethinking of the role that hallucinogenic plants and fungi have played in the promotion of human emergence from primate organization can help lead to a new appreciation of the unique confluence of factors responsible and necessary for the evolution of human beings. The widely felt intuition of the presence of the other as a goddess can be traced back to society's immersion in the vegetable mind. This sense of the female companion explains the persistent intrusion themes of the mother goddess, even into the most patriarchal domains. The persistence of the cult of Mary in Christianity is a case in point, as is the fervor reserved for the cult of Kali, the destroying mother, and the idea of the divine Purusha in Hinduism. The anima mundi, the soul of the world, of hermetic thought, is another image of the goddess of the world. Ultimately, all of these female images are reducible to the archetype of the original vegetable mind. Immersion in the psychedelic experience provided the ritual context in which human consciousness emerged into the light of self-awareness, self-reflection, and self-articulation, into the light of Gaia, the Earth herself. Gaian Holism. Deconstruction of dominator cultural values means promotion of what may be called a sense of Gaian holism, that is, a sense of the unity and balance of nature and of our own position within that dynamic, evolving balance. It is a plant-based view. This return to a perspective on self and ego that places them within the larger context of planetary life and evolution is the essence of the archaic revival. Marshall McLuhan was correct to see that planetary human culture, the global village, would be tribal in character. The next great step toward a planetary holism is the partial merging of the technologically transformed human world with the archaic matrix of vegetable intelligence that is the transcendent other. I hesitate to characterize this dawning awareness as religious, yet that is what it surely is. And it will involve a full exploration of the dimensions revealed by plant hallucinogens, especially those structurally related to neurotransmitters already present in the human brain. Careful exploration of the plant hallucinogens will probe the most archaic and sensitive level of the drama of the emergence of consciousness, the plant-human quasi-symbiotic relationship that characterized archaic society and religion and through which the numinous mystery was originally experienced. And this experience is no less mysterious for us today, in spite of the general assumption that we have replaced the simple awe of our ancestors with philosophical and epistemic tools of the utmost sophistication and analytical power. Now our choice as a planetary culture is a simple one: go green or die.